You might turn to the book of Exodus. We'll start there in a minute. The first thing we're going to do is going to be a regular segment. I like to call it, Where is Jeff? We'll probably make it an annual thing. I know last summer we did. For those who don't know, Jeff Wilson is one of our regular preachers, and he is at camp this week. And he'll be at different places throughout the summer. I've been tabbed to fill in for him when he's out. So you'll see me sometimes, you'll see him other times. So where is Jeff next week will be easy. He should be here, assuming everyone's healthy. We're going to get into the book of Exodus this quarter. I'll start us off this week. Like I said, we'll be in and out depending on week to week, but Jeff and I sat and just kind of divvied the book up. If you're a person like myself who likes outlines and likes to just kind of know where to file things, Exodus is one of the simplest books that you can make an outline for. It's got two parts. So for the first part of the quarter, we're going to do Exodus chapters 1 through 15. And then 16 through 40 is the second section. We probably all, if we were to sit around and talk about everything we know about the book of Exodus, my guess is 70% of what we would answer is all from the first 15 chapters. We could probably get most of the rest of it, but it would probably be more of the flavor of Leviticus versus the back half of Exodus. And that's kind of how the book of Exodus is. We all have all these experiences that has flavored our reading of the book of Exodus. And if we're not careful, it's one of those books that's so familiar that we don't really pay attention to it. That, you know, our kids may go off to Bible class and come back, and what'd you learn tonight? Oh, I learned about the 10 plagues. Oh, that's great. Hey, did you know that each plague is an Egyptian god? And we just covered like half of the first section. And then we move on. Or if you were like myself, I grew up deep into the Pine Curtain, behind the Pine Curtain, for those who don't know, that's East Texas. And not a lot gets through to East Texas, at least not for years, right? So I didn't have like satellite or cable or anything like that growing up out in the Pine Hills. And so what I did have was a public library, and they had an extensive collection of Disney shows from the 50s. And one of the shows that I would regularly get is the Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston. Some of y'all may be familiar with it. Super popular when it came out. I didn't realize till I started rewatching it today, get ready for class. It's almost 4 hours long, and you know, this is of the era of you had to sit through the credits first before they'd let you watch the movie. I mean, when it just popped up Overture and nothing had happened yet, I was like, how do you skip this? I only made it through about halfway through the movie, and that was more just to have it on the background while I was actually like reading and doing other things. But when I think of the 10 plagues, when I think of Moses, when I think of Exodus, I hear Charlton Heston. Mm-hmm. And as I watched it, I realized how far off that movie is. But that's my background of the book of Exodus. I haven't even gotten to the 10 plagues part of the movie yet, so don't ruin it. but the first half of the movie is just his life before he leaves. Like, the 2 hour, you know, basically 2 hours of that movie is the first two chapters. And we know basically nothing of Moses' life other than he was born, he was put in a basket, he lived for 40 years, and then he had to get out of there. And so you can imagine, you know, what the movie did with all of that, if you haven't seen it. I won't ruin it. It's fine. So our plan is going to be on this side of the board. We're going to get into the background here in a second. There's going to be some themes that we're going to hit across. The big two is going to be the living God versus someone like Pharaoh, for example, and Providence, which is a great place for Exodus to pick up, because as we move into the background, what has just happened, like in our Bibles? You know, where, how does Genesis end? And you don't have to be specific what happened in 50. Like the last 20 chapters of the book of Genesis covers basically one character and his family.
Joseph,
right? Abraham and his descendants. So Genesis 12, you start with Abraham, and for the rest of the Bible, it's covering the descendants of Abraham, either through the physical lineage, the Hebrews, that we're going to study some, or us in this room, children by faith of the seed of Abraham. And so when God delivers those promises in Genesis 12, he's working on delivering those promises. And so between Genesis 50 and Exodus 1, which it covers the background a little bit there in those first few verses, you're going to have him delivering on essentially one of those big promises, and that being him having a great nation after him. So let's dig into it a little bit. So if we look at just the background of, well, let's start with Egypt. I am not an Egyptologist. That is a thing. There are places set up that all they do is talk about Egypt. I am nowhere near any of that. Like, I've watched the Ten Plagues, or the Ten Commandments. I can't even get the name of the movie right. I watched that, and despite being a history major in college, my bachelor's, I didn't spend a lot of time in Egypt. I know some basics, which we'll talk about today. And then after that, y'all are on your own. If I step out too far out of my depth, please bring me back. I did a quick tally. I think I'm the sixth youngest person in the room. So collectively, we have more experience to give me than I have to give any of y'all. And so I'm gonna depend on y'all to help this class out, because we need each other if we're gonna make it through all this. As far as Egypt goes, when you hear Egypt, what are some big things that y'all think of without getting like too specific into the pharaohs and that kind of stuff?
Pyramids.
What was that? I heard pyramids, is that what I heard?
Nile River.
The Nile, yeah, which is going to play, well, I'll keep it on the side. It's going to play a big part in both of their lives, but the Nile is going to be a bigger part in Egypt.
Well, pharaohs.
Pharaohs. And I've already misspelled one word. It's going to be more. If y'all haven't been in class with me before, my handwriting's terrible. So is my spelling. Just ignore it. Get the big idea. That's probably not how you spell pharaoh.
The tomb.
Tomb. I'm going to put this kind of in the middle, because it's going to be drawn on by both.
So the mythology, the idols.
Okay.
Idolatry.
God. So.
If any of y'all were looking for the singing class, you can hear it now. You don't want me to lead singing. I'll go after we leave this room and go in the auditorium. I'll be leading singing. So no one's going to escape my
slavery.
Slavery.
Bondage.
Yeah. For the Egyptians, which we don't get this in scripture, but one of the biggest ideas from the Egyptians is they were so proud of their race and of their people and their culture that they prided themselves on not actually building any of their monuments. So the Israelites are going to build some of them, which we'll talk about, but they also captured and enslaved a bunch of other people that built the other stuff. So if it's big and if it's in Egypt, their big thing is, we didn't build it. That's how cool we are.
They designed it.
A lot of it was designed like that.
Well, I think of clay bricks.
Bricks? That'll play a central role. They're gonna make it, they're not gonna.
said it's a pan.
Okay. Should I share that in common? I'm not even going to try to write descendant. The reason I wrote Ham, if anybody's looking later, you know, Noah gets off the ark. One of his descendants sons is Ham, and even the word Egyptian in Hebrew is descendant of Ham, basically. Jeff will explain it more next week. I can't even get into it all, but that's my understanding.
Chariots.
Chariots, yeah. Unfortunately, they're going to share that in common later, but it plays a bigger part with the Egyptians on this side.
A lot of Egypt is desert.
Okay. The wilderness is going to play a big part. I'm going to go put it way over.
Red Sea.
Red Sea.
Red Sea.
They were the superpower of the time.
Yeah. We'll draw through the rest of the quarter. We're going to draw parallels. We're at a really great time here at Claymont because our readings match up with our Bible classes really, really well. Thank you, Scott Parker. I saw you. There you are right there. You usually sit over there when everyone are in our meetings or over there. So Exodus and Matthew go together by design. So if you read through Matthew like we are, you're going to see how Christ is the prophet like Moses. I won't ruin it. Get into Exodus 4 next week. But when you read through Exodus 4, the stories just pop off the page. It's one of those times where it struck me how much I have been flavored by Charleston Heston and that idea, you know, the Bible class version of Exodus. And I hadn't actually just sat and read Exodus beyond, read the Bible in a year kind of a way where I was just kind of cruising. And, yep, I can do it. Now I'm going to move on to my other stuff. Exodus 4 is just dense with Christ references that Matthew is going to highlight especially.
Gold and treasures.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to spell treasure, so. It's going to, I'll even put arrows. It was in Egypt, but it's going to end up with Israel by the end of the book. For the sake of time, I'm going to move into some of this and kind of highlight some contexts so that we can get more into chapters 1 and 2. There's some debate on the actual years that, you know, the 400 years or the 430 years happened between Genesis 50 and Exodus 1. The best explanation I've heard is there's a period of time where when Joseph came and was prominent, and then the time that there arose a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph, you know, chapter 1, verse 8, that probably, and I'm not even going to write his name, so I'll get that wrong too. There was a Pharaoh that for a period of time, there were an invading nation that came into Egypt, and they were called the Shepherd Kings, if you're reading history things. And the shepherd kings ruled for, you know, 300 to 400 years or so. And then an Egyptian pharaoh rose up and regained power. And so that pharaoh seems most likely to be the pharaoh that arose that knew not Joseph. And he was all about restoring Egyptian things, you know, casting off the shepherd kings, and making Egypt central again. He had a renewed emphasis on rebuilding cities, which required a lot of bricks. He was rebuilding monuments that had been torn down. He was, you know, make Egypt great again for this period of time. And so he was trying to rebuild it all, needed a workforce, and there you have him in is it Gershon? Gershon? Y'all didn't hear me mispronounce a lot of things today, probably. on the east side of Egypt, you got the Israelites living, and he put them to work. And so it was probably around this time that we're talking history-wise. You can see why that would make a little sense, make more sense in Egyptian history, given what the Israelites do. They are shepherds, which is why they lived where they lived and were given the land they were given. And then the invaders would have come from the east, because almost all invasions of Egypt came from the east. And they seem rather similar, even though they're not. And they were put to work, and they were afraid of them because of how quickly they grew in number, and they go through a measure of ways of trying to control the population. We'll talk about here in a second. Egypt, how they rose to power is through agriculture. The Nile is very predictable. It floods every year, around this time actually. Well, we're a little early in the season, about mid-June. Egypt, the Nile River is going to flood. It's not a matter of if it's going to flood. It's more of a matter of, please, we hope it floods at least X amount so that they can have as much agriculture as they need. If it just floods some, they can maybe feed some, but they're not able to be the powerhouse that we know they are because they end up feeding, I mean, they're called the breadbasket because they feed lots of people all around. It was no mistake that Joseph ended up there and God providentially brought the rest of them in there because there was a famine in the land of Canaan and Egypt had food. That was an exceptional thing. Lots of people go to Egypt because they have food. That carries out. It may still be carrying itself out. I didn't brush up on modern Egyptian economy. But even as late as World War II, there was important things about Egypt that they had to secure. But when we get into comparing time periods, it's very interesting when you parallel why Christ came when he came and why Moses came when he came. Because you look at the powers that were involved, there were a lot of very similar things. And I didn't want to make the map too complicated, or else I put Rome in here and we'd really fill it all out. But you think height of culture, you think height of reading, you think of height of learnedness. Egypt was known for that. They had probably the first library in Alexandria. And until it was destroyed and burned down and things like that, it housed a lot of very important books. When Moses gets brought up as the son of Egyptian royalty, he has a privileged position that would have positioned him far better than anywhere else he could have been. When I looked up what contemporaries are, because a lot of our history, given where we are right now, is bent towards Western civilization. But even when you look Eastern civilization or American, North and South American civilizations, nothing was at this level. It would take the rest of the world hundreds, maybe even 1,000 or more years in some cases, to get close to where the Egyptians are right now in the book of Exodus. And so for God to bring up Moses now, there would not have been a more powerful place. He didn't do this in the dark. He didn't pick, middle of nowhere to make a nation. He picked the center stage to do this. Years later, whenever they're making their way into the promised land, Jericho had heard about the things that happened in Egypt. Rahab helps them because she knows what happened in Egypt. And that's, 40 to 50 years after that. Other people here as well. And so it is really interesting that Egypt is the stage that God picked for Moses and the Israelites to come out.
It was per your point, and I appreciate it, it was also the best way for God to demonstrate his power, right? Egypt wasn't a second-rate military power or second-rate country. God overthrew the most powerful country in the world at the time. So that had quite a bit of reverberation across the world, the known world at the time.
And if it's the time period that it seemed to make sense to me and a lot of other people, this was at the height of it. When they regained power after that period of the invading shepherd kings, as they were called, when they got that back, they were doubling down on everything. And so, yeah, God proving his power at this point with these people proves he's the living God, as we see. As you read through Exodus 1, and we won't take the time to read all the verses, what should stand out, or at least what stood out to me, is God's providence in all of this. So to contrast Moses to Christ in some extent, you know, Christ was picked. He was born into a certain family. He was born at the place he needed to be born at. Signs were given, you know, there's the star that brought the Magi in, you know, it was announced. Moses was not. Moses was born to, from what we can tell, a Levite family that had no claim to anything. Even if they were in a place that they owned, the Levites were never a land-inherited group. And so here he is being born to Levites at a time where kids were being killed. They were worried about the size getting too big. They were worried about them joining their enemies, which they had just cast off. So you could see how that could be fresh on their minds. And so rather than kill the labor force, let's just weed out the numbers a little bit. Let's put a gap in the demographics. Let's just slaughter kids, basically. And they do. They attempt it in two different ways. The first way is talking to the midwives. What do the midwives do when they're given a charge? Hey, mom delivers, go ahead and take care of the baby right then. What do the midwives do?
They save them.
They save them, right?
Yeah.
From what we can tell here in Exodus, they may not have even mentioned it to the mothers, you know. If anybody asks, you know, I wasn't here. Or anything like that. They just come back to Pharaoh after he kind of wants a status check, and they say, wow, those ladies, they're just so vigorous. Before we even get down there, they've already had the kid. What are we supposed to do at that point? And so he goes to plan B, which is, well, since they're having them anyway, we're just going to kill them. We're going to throw them in the Nile and be done with it that way. Which introduces us to Moses in chapter 2. Moses, again, born. His parents are mentioned. I can't find their names right off the top of my head. But in the end, their names really aren't important. There's not much of a reference to them beyond this moment. We read in other scripture, through other inspired writers, kind of more to the context of Exodus 2 than we do actually in Exodus 2. I wrote the other verses here that you're welcome to write down or turn in reference right now. In Acts 7, Stephen, as he's recounting their history and how rebellious the Israelites have been from the beginning, references that it's faithful people that he's born into. In Psalm 78, this is just being a song, there are references that compare, you know, the boat and the ark, which is an interesting comparison. And then Acts, or I already said the Acts, in Hebrews 11 we get the most description of this being done. And the Hebrew writer says that it was by faith that he was put in a boat, in the reeds, and put into the Nile. And then by faith, Moses does the other things that we're going to talk about. And so we know that this was a faithful family, We know that, again, that they were Levites. And we know that they had two other kids. At this point, it seems Miriam is fairly grown, if not fully what would be considered, you know, a full-grown woman at this time. She was pretty close to it. Her age is compared and mentioned in other verses. And Aaron is 3 years old, which would put him just beyond what Moses, you know, being born and the limit being 2 years and younger, it put him beyond that. It also, from what I read, and this is just as good as me saying it to y'all, the age in Egypt seems to be for nursing and rearing to be about 3 years old. And so when Moses is put in the reeds and Pharaoh's daughter finds him, and you know his mom ends up becoming his nurse, to nurse him to where he no longer needs a mother's nursing, seems to be about 3 years. From what everyone seems to think makes the most sense in for the culture at the time. Verse 5, as you kind of read the description, it's interesting just kind of how it happens. You know, verse 3, mom has made the wicker basket, which I'm not a big language person as far as Hebrew and all the other words. You know, next week, Jeff, if you're watching, he can describe more, but the word could be compared to boat or ark. And so when you read the description and it talks about it being covered in pitch, there's another boat that we know of that was covered in inside and outside in pitch, being Noah's Ark. And so it's interesting, once again, Noah comparisons come up with water, that Moses is delivered by water here, put in the water, and then he's discovered. His sister stands at the distance, Miriam watches, and even in some historical Egyptian accounts, or at least one, there seems to be a pretty very similar in this time period story of one of, they were co-regents. There was actually two sisters that led Egypt for a short period, and one of them found a child in the Nile. You know, there's no way anyone can be dogmatic and say, yep, that's for sure Moses, or say, nope, it's not Moses. But it's really cool if you think about it. And being a co-regent would also make a lot of sense of, here you have an edict to kill all children within this age range that she finds, and she gets to keep Moses. One, she's Pharaoh's daughter, so you could always play, daddy's girl always kind of gets her way. Or she's a co-regent and she's partly ruling the country at this point, and if she says she gets to keep the kid, then guess what? She gets to keep the kid. And so Pharaoh's daughter finds him and needs somebody. Sister supplies the nurse. So not only does she get to keep her son, but she gets to raise him for an extended period. You know, when we think modern America nursing period, less than a year is really, really the most common. But in history, it's far from that. Historically, more than a year. More like 2, 3, some civilizations as old as, you know, like 5. And so Moses growing up and at the age of 40 making that decision doesn't seem as far off when his mom's been raising him in that initial crucial first few years. You know, starting from birth through, you know, what could have been 3 to 5 years old. You know, I can remember some crucial things whenever I was 5. We could all go around the room and remember. The things we remember are pivotal, crucial memories for the most part. They inform us, they inform who we are. Even the ones that we can't call up, we've internalized the lessons. And Moses' choice later on in the chapter seems to be marked in these first few years. Uh, you get further down, verse 11, it says, now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So earlier we mentioned that the Egyptians had a great pride about, you know, they never built their own monuments. The Egyptian taskmaster, the slave master, was an honored position. It wasn't just, you know, kind of like you look through our history, the slave masters and the taskmasters, those were not good people. You know, good civilized southerners were gentry. You know, they stayed away from all of that. That all happened far away, and less honorable people ran the system. That's not Egypt. Egypt, this is a position of power, this is a position of prominence. You know, I am building the monuments by telling people what to do. You know, they have the whips, they have the, and even the whips and things, this wasn't just like they found whatever they could to kind of get the point across. They had specific tools of their trade. And so when Moses strikes down this Egyptian, there's not a mystery why it spreads like it does. You know, later, two Hebrews are arguing, and he's kind of stepping in to mediate, and they say, what, are you going to kill me too? And then it strikes him, oh, wow, people know what I did. Because in the beginning, you know, he looks left, and he looks right, seeing if anybody's watching before he strikes him down. Everybody knows. You've got royalty walking around. I'm sure everyone knew where he was. Kind of like, you know, I worked in an elementary school. We all know where the principal is. You know, she can't sneak around the campus. Okay? So he's out walking around. He strikes down another person that's really important. Everybody knows. Probably before Moses was able to bury him, everybody knew. And then it hits him. Wow, everybody knows. And Pharaoh gets word too, goes out to strike him down, and that's when he flees. And he's 40 years old at this point. You know, if you watch the movie, The Ten Commandments, you know, he's a strapping, tall, you know, brave man who made his choice, things like that. That's not the picture it seems in Scripture. Scripture is, he's 40 years old. It seems like he understands who he is, that he's going to mount his brethren, the Hebrews. But when he made his choice, it wasn't out in the open. He's looking both ways to see if anybody's watching. And then he makes his choice and realizes his choice is sealed. You know, there's no going back. And that's when he flees. And where does he flee to? The wilderness. So he's prepared for this position he's going to take. You know, into chapters 3 and 4. We'll talk about that more next week with Jeff. But he's prepared in the wilderness to take the position. Which, if you're drawing parallels at this point in the story to him and Christ, you know, given our reading in Matthew, Christ does his baptism, and where does he go? The wilderness. He goes out into the wilderness, and he gets prepared for delivering the people. It's very interesting to think about Moses as a person being prepared at this point. Because as you read his experience in the land of Midian, he does some things to kind of endear him over to his, you know, future in-laws, you know, to his wife's family. But it doesn't appear to seem like they put him in a very prominent position. He becomes the nice guy, marries into the family, and he's the one shepherding. He's the one watching sheep. You know, you think of all the parallels Moses is going to draw throughout Scripture. You know, I'm thinking David at this point. You know, everybody else, all the important people are at the house. And what is Moses doing when he's, you know, discovers the burning bush? He's out shepherding. He goes from Egyptian royalty, 40 years. You know, I'm about to hit 40 this year in a couple of months. And I think of all the habits I have that are entrenched, that if someone just came and tried to teach me, it might take a little bit of time. This is Moses at this point. And so when he starts his new life, he has his midlife crisis, right? And he's now starting his swan song. He gets another three chapters after this. He gets, when he goes back, you know, he's 80 years old whenever he says, let my people go. So he spends some time being humbled. And this, the lesson obviously sticks, because when you read of Moses, I can't remember the verse off the top of my head. One of the scriptures say he was, if it doesn't say he was the most humble person to ever live, it says that he was, you know, definitely top five, probably. He keeps God from destroying the Israelites at several points, just because, again, it just seems like he's got this contriteness, this humble spirit about him, that he's got to plead for. He saves his sister and his brother when they rebel. He does a lot of things that if he had stayed as Egyptian royalty, he may not have done those things. He may not have done them as well as he did, which is ironic, depending, you know, considering how he kind of kept himself out of the land of the promised land, where he let pride consume him at that point and strikes the rock instead of speaks to it. But as we read through and we kind of get to the human part of what's going on in Scripture right now, Moses is a really interesting and one of the most dynamic and in-depth people in Scripture. And so most accounts, like if you read through Egyptian things, they're not giving you the human side of these pharaohs. You know, you read their hieroglyphics, it's more like, this God came to earth and he struck all enemies. You know, it'd be more like reading a comic book where, you know, they just come through and with his laser eyes, he just like blew his enemies away. You know, that thousands and thousands of people just threw themselves down and worshiped him. And that's how we got all of this food. That's Egyptian mythology. That's how they tell stories. And they're the rule. Everybody tells stories like that. You know, I won't go too far with this comment, but think about, like, history class. When you go and you read history, like, we read about Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie and all these people at the Alamo. If you want to keep them, you know, these huge mythological figures, don't go read about their personal lives, because they were regular people that made some big regular people mistakes. God's not interested in making Moses to be God. You know, if he wanted Moses to be a Pharaoh, he would have left him where he was. But he wants him to be, you know, the pre-Christ, the shadow of Christ. And so when we read, like, Isaiah 53 about how Christ, you know, was ugly and no one wanted to look at him and no one wanted to follow him and he was beaten and smitten and all these things, that's more the spirit of Moses than, you know, the Ten Commandments, Charleston and Heston, you know, with his big booming voice, let my people go. You know, Moses is going to be complaining in two chapters from now, I can't do this. Pick somebody else. And he's got to have Aaron come along with him. And God gives him, like, on-demand miracles. You know, you think about all the things that we do, and we have the get-out-of-jail-free cards and the phone-a-friends, and, you know, if you pay $4.99 more, they'll give you these extra lives. Moses is like, I don't want any of it. Please, somebody else. God gives him all of it. And he still ends up being the main character. He still ends up being the one who leads the people out.
Seems like they were the most powerful military around. They would have struck him down and killed him as soon as he came.
Yeah.
But he didn't.
But God protected him.
Yeah.
God took care of it. So keep all of this in mind. This is just the setup. This is all just the background as you read through it. If I could highlight Exodus 4, go read it multiple times. As you read through Matthew multiple times, and you be prepared, because I'm sure what Jeff's got is going to be connections and a lot of other things. Yes, ma'am.
You know, Moses had a speech impediment, and then he was reluctant to be out front because of that. You know, we have our own issues with ourselves, and we're reluctant in ways to be highlighted. And so they, you know, let history be told the way he was depicted, like Charlton Heston. He was strong and strong voice and all of that. So it was never like what the scripture says.
Yeah.
And God chose him. He uses the weak things of the world to confound the wise.
Yeah. It's really interesting hearing you know. And if I had more time, I would have filled out this side of the contrasts. You know, like we've got a peasant, slave people shepherding, while the breadbasket of the world, you know, is learning. But that was our bell. Stay tuned. We need some.